From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2008, Brad Crowder and David McKay were fed up. These were two young men from Midland, Texas, who were in the process of sorting out their views of the world. And they were angry about the war in Iraq, about the stories of torture, the handling of Hurricane Katrina. They wanted to express this anger by protesting the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis that year. Turns out Brad and David were arrested for making Molotov cocktails. The government called it a case of domestic terrorism. Today in the program, we're talking about a documentary film that tells the story. One of the central figures in the government's case was an informant who played a role in motivating Brad and David's sense of activism. So there are questions about whether they were manipulated or misled. But the film is also about the nature of justice in this country and the limits of ideology and activism. We invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a lot going on in the documentary film Better This World. It's built around the story of a crime. Two young men from Midland, Texas, who were arrested for making Molotov cocktails when they went to protest the Republican National Convention in 2008. So part of this is the crime and the elements that lead us up to that point. Part of it is the case the government makes. Federal prosecutors called it a case of domestic terrorism. But one of the central figures in their case was an informant who played an important role in motivating David and Brad. So the film raises the questions of whether they were misled or manipulated. You know, was this a case of entrapment? But there are broader themes going on as well, about the nature of the country's judicial system, about the limits and the lure of idealism, even about the boundaries of friendship. The film, again, is called Better This World. It's a screening next week as part of the Salt Lake City Film Festival, and we'll give you details about that as well as other airings going on around the country. Today in the program, we're talking about the film and the themes in it. We invite you to join us if you like. If you have questions or comments, 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Today in the program, joining us are the filmmakers Katie Galloway and Kelly Duane De La Vega, who co-directed and co-produced Better This World. Galloway has directed and produced numerous films for PBS Frontline and POV. She was a 2010 Sundance Documentary Fellow, teaches media studies at UC Berkeley, and she's joining us today from a studio in Oakland, California. And Katie Galloway, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Kelly Duane De La Vega was also a 2010 Sundance Documentary Fellow. Her documentaries have been broadcast on PBS and on the Documentary Channel. I mentioned that the film is going to be screened at the Salt Lake Film Festival, and as I said, we'll give you details about that as we go along. But Kelly Duane De La Vega, welcome to you. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I guess we should begin with the obvious question. When did you guys first hear about Brad and David, and what did you, when you were first thinking about it, what did you figure this film was about, if you even thought about it in those terms?
Well, we found, this is Katie, and we found out about it when an article came out in the newspaper in early 2009. I picked up a copy of The Times, and it said that a well-known activist had come out as an informant and was sort of letting the activist community know after being outed that he was, in fact, an informant in the case of two young men from Midland, Texas, David and Brad, right, who had been arrested for domestic terrorism at the RNC. And I thought it, from this sort of short piece in the Times that I read, it was interesting that the young men were from Midland, Texas, because this is George Bush's hometown. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what had led them on the journey they had been on, whatever that had been. And also, I had noticed, like probably some of your listeners have, that since 9/11, there have been a number of cases where there's been an allegation of domestic terrorism, and then the defense, or at least one of the accused, has made a counter allegation of entrapment, or of at least, you know, misdeeds by a government agent or informant in their case. So the case of David McKay was about to go to trial about a week later, and Kelly and I talked about it and decided that this would be a really good opportunity to look closely at a case that we had sort of seen a pattern of and find out what had really happened here.
But it was, I guess it was a hunch, right? You weren't sure exactly how the stories were going to play out. I mean, but you saw a kernel of something there. Can you say exactly what that was, or you weren't quite sure at that time, maybe.
This is Kelly. And yeah, you know, a lot of it is a hunch when you're first thinking about a story. And we just sort of made a decision between the two of us that we would go to Minneapolis and try to meet as many of the characters as possible and, you know, take a gamble that there was a story there. And then in the process of doing it, we'd make a decision of whether we would move forward or not. And on the eve of David's trial, we were able to get in and meet with him at Sherburne County Jail. And he really was such an interesting, open character that we felt like there was something really there. His defense attorney was open to us. And we just started, you know, we started a conversation with the informant on the phone. And he was a very interesting person. And so we started to see the different sides of the, you know, the various perspectives involved with the case. And we felt by the time we were headed home, we knew there was a film. And we didn't know how it was going to play out, obviously. Yeah. But we knew that it was touching on a lot of complicated themes that really interested both of us in a very deep sort of core way.
Because it seems like that, you know, you have the case of, you know, the nature of the, you know, the judicial system, the system of justice in the days or the years post 9/11. OK, that seems to be it. There are the particular elements about the trial. But I think what makes the film compelling are the relationships. I wonder if that surprised you. And in particular, talk, if you would, about David and Brad, because in some ways, the film is about the essence of their relationship, you know, whether it's going to withstand the pressures that are going to come with this case.
Well, you know, I think that whenever there's a lot of interesting stories in terms of like the themes they hit on, right, or the political threads they pick up on, but they don't make for great movies, frankly, right? It's like they make for brilliant newspaper articles or magazine articles. But so for me, the core, and Katie as well, was, are these characters interesting people? Do I want to spend time with them? Do I want to get to know them? So initially, you know, we're looking at these characters and we felt like, yes. But the friendship was very, very, you know, was a very key part of our story. And can two kids have each other's back? And we all, you know, we've seen enough television and movies to know that once you're in a position where you're facing real time and you're being threatened, if you don't cop a plea or you don't give information on your, you know, your friend or whoever you committed the crime with, you can get into some, you know, there are serious consequences.
Yeah.
So watching their loyalty to each other really hit a strong chord for us. And we felt like, wow, this is a very important thread to include into our narrative.
And just to follow up on that for a second, I think, you know, the relationship between the informant and the young men, the informant was 10 years older than these two young men, and they look to him, they've described him in various ways, but one way that I think is really telling is sort of as a coach who puts you to the test, and as they're sort of on, I mean, they were over 21, both of them. They were 22 and 23 when this started, but in some sense still, you know, somewhere between boys and men. And they saw the informant as a mentor figure. Mm-hmm. And so watching how that unfolded over the course of 6 months really became the sort of backbone of our story, what happened from the time they met to the time they were arrested.
When we first meet them in the film, we get a sense just how early on, their sense of thinking about the world is. As you said, they come from Midland. There's a clip here I want to play. We hear both Brad and David, because these aren't stereotypical activists. And you get a sense of how they're coming of age, how they're thinking about all of this. Here's a clip from the film Better This World.
Brad is one of, I guess I can say, one of my most trusted and good friends that I have.
David is a very, very good friend. And I mean, I love David. He's an artist and, you know, an athlete. He was just a really intense, charismatic guy. He was such a different person in Midland.
I don't know. I felt like I wanted to be part of something else. I wanted to I guess, experience a lot more. I didn't really know a lot, but you know, I had a lot of dreams of doing lots of adventures.
He was a little bit political before I met him, but through our relationship, you know, and the debates that we would have became more and more and more politicized.
We've done a lot of growing together as friends, and I think that's how you can tell that you have a good friend.
I remember we would just walk the city at night, you know, because in downtown Midland is empty at night. There's nothing there. And we would have the entire downtown to ourselves, and we would just talk. We were raised in Midland, Texas, which is a really conservative, you know, atmosphere, and there's not a lot of activists at all. There's barely even a Democratic Party. I've always felt more, you know, like I'm more NRA than Greenpeace, I guess, you know? I was just raised that way. My whole dad's side of the family, they're all ropers and, you know, rodeo folk. So that's my redneck street cred.
His street cred, which it's interesting that the way the story sort of plays out, it seems like, and I wanted to get your perspective on this, this is about how far they're willing to go. I mean, they talk about this stuff endlessly, but the thing that seems to turn is how far they're willing to go. What are they willing to do for this idealism? That seems an important theme, Katie and Kelly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that Brad talks about, who's the one at the end of the clip there, whose family was in the rodeo, he talks about really sort of coming of age politically in a vacuum, as he mentioned, barely even a Democratic Party in Midland. He did not identify really at all with sort of stereotypical leftist activists. Sure. And so when he and David met Brandon, it was, you know, they were in the sort of origin, the infancy of their politicization, and not really affiliated or connected with any other kind of activist network. So, you know, and one of the things that they talk about Brandon saying is sort of, are you one of these stereotypical activists, or are you really ready to sort of do whatever it takes for your beliefs, you know, because people are dying all over the world and there's no time to sit around. We need to take action. What that meant was very ambiguous in many cases, but it was a sort of we need to emphasize that we never interviewed Brandon directly ourselves, but the language of the documents that we used and the you know, recordings that we have, all the archival, there is a strong strain of militancy of like needing to act now. And that's certainly what David and Brad report was a kind of egging on to always some more dramatic action.
I want to play that part of the film actually here. But first, so we've moved sort of from talking about Brandon as the informant to calling him Brandon. How do you guys talk about Brandon? Because people know the story, of course, but there's this revelation that comes to the film, which it seems important to it. And so I'm just wondering how you're talking about it. Can we call him Brandon? And what can we say, I guess? Because I always feel uneasy about this with filmmakers. I mean, people do know the story, but it is a kind of wrenching moment, you know?
It's tricky, yeah. And it's you know, Kelly and I talked about this before. Like, how do we? It's our first hour-long interview. Is it possible to not spoil it? Is it difficult to not spoil
it in a
3-minute interview?
Yeah.
We can talk about Brandon. I think we decided that we were going to for this discussion today. And many people who have seen the film know the story and still, you know, sort of talk about it as a, you know, revelation. It still comes as a sucker punch when you find out that the mentor is the informant. It's in terms of talking about him and his motivations, we again didn't interview him ourselves, so we glean what
we should say that, right?
Certainly did, yeah. And Kelly can talk a little bit about that if you like, but we had many court documents. We had other, you know, the interviews with FBI agents. We have archival interviews of Brandon. And we feel like we sort of deeply know Brandon in the film in terms of what he represented to these young men who he was involved with, David and Brad. But in terms of really knowing what his motivations were, very difficult for us to speak to that. I mean, we've heard plenty of theories in making the film for 2 years, but I think that still remains, you know, something that perhaps only Brandon knows.
We'll talk.
And, you know, this is Kelly. I was just going to say, I did spend some time on the phone with Brandon, but I don't think we need to get off on him too much, but I think it is important at some levels that, you know, because we don't have firsthand interviews with him on the record, it feels we get in a difficult situation when people want to talk about him too much because we don't, you know, we know the other characters in a really intimate way, and we know Brandon through archival footage and transcripts.
So we'll hear one of those archival transcripts, I guess an actor reading Brandon Darby's voice in this clip. They're at a coffee shop. I think it's Brad. Yes, Brad, David, and Brandon. And this is one of those things where you get a sense of him sort of testing them, pushing about what they really are prepared to do, I guess, for their sense of idealism. Here's another clip from the film Better This World.
March 6, 2008, meeting at Ventana del Sol. I arrived approximately 30 minutes early for the meeting. Brad and David arrived together. I stated that I wanted to sit outside and make sure that no one heard our discussion. The two of them consented.
I remember we were sitting at a coffee shop. It's one that David goes to all the time to do artwork. Brandon met us there and we were talking, you know, let's talk about what we want, what we're comfortable with here, what we want to accomplish. And Brandon was like, I don't want to talk. I don't want to work out our adolescent, you know, daddy issues.
I stated that I wasn't interested in being part of a group if we were going to sit and talk too much. I used several analogies and personal stories to explain further how I felt about the manner in which activists usually interact and how I thought it was why we were so ineffective.
He means business. He does not want to sit around and in meetings all day. He wants to go up there to shut it down. And, you know, he said, I'm going to shut that down.
I stated that I was going to shut that down.
So, Kelly and Katie, talk about what David and Brad are hearing. I mean, they have this sort of really burgeoning sense of activism, and they meet this incredibly charismatic person, and there's this opportunity that's coming, the Republican National Convention. And in some ways, I guess for Brandon or anyway for Brad and David, that like this is a test. How far are they willing to go, I guess?
Well, so, you know, this little clip that you heard there of their first meeting is documented so well because it was actually written by Brandon in his first letter to the FBI. And it becomes the backbone of the entrapment case of David's case. It's a very long letter. It's the only one like it because after the first one, his handler suggested to him that he not go into so much detail. But in his own words, he's, you know, what Brad says, I told him I was going to shut this down. And, you know, there were all kinds of really provocative statements that Brandon documented in that first meeting. And I think, you know, to read it, to hear it in trial and to hear David and Brad, you know, to hear all the corroboration of the kind of language that was used, it's really hard to take it any other way than really pushing to sort of extreme action from my perspective. And I think, you know, I guess reasonable people could disagree, but it really does seem, I mean, this idea that I don't want to hang around with people that want to sit around and talk. I want to be with people who are going to do something. And are you willing to die for what you believe in? Very provocative language and something that really influenced David and Brad. I mean, they describe it, the feeling that they needed to live up to Brandon's expectations and they needed to show him that they were really willing to sort of follow in his more militant footsteps in order to be real people of conscience and in order to be people who really showed that they cared about the injustices of the world.
And I think one thing to note about Brandon is that he really did some very impressive work in Katrina. And he, you know, he braved toxic waters to save people who were, you know, in a desperate situation. And he had done things that somebody who cares about trying to make a difference could very readily admire. I also think, you know, what Brandon would say is that he was, you know, he was tasked to play sort of a character undercover, and that his behavior was in line with trying to fit in with the group.
So before we head into a break, I just wanted to one of the compelling things, it's interesting the way you're talking about Brandon, like you feel uneasy about saying too much about him in some ways. But so if you're uncomfortable with this question, then you don't answer it. But it seems like the way we see Brandon Darby after it's revealed that he is the informant, even just the images that we see, not that you've tainted them, not that you've colored them, but our perspective changes. Whether we knew the story or not, it is a grand revelation. And you start to wonder, surely he was an activist and he did noble things, as you say, in New Orleans. But, you know, you do start to wonder, because he's so mysterious in some ways, was some of this an act? What are his intentions? What are his motivations? I mean, that is a question that has to come up all the time when you're talking to people who've seen the film, right?
It certainly does, and it swirls around Brandon and, you know, sort of the other case he worked, his work after Hurricane Katrina at Common Ground. There are a lot of questions about, you know, at what point he became an informant or started giving information. And the question is even raised by some about whether he was ever a, quote, real activist, or whether his whole life as an activist was some kind of brilliant deep cover. I think that from anecdotally, having talked to a lot of people, I think the weight is sort of on the side of his having been a really committed, genuine activist, and then having become, you know, started to cooperate with the government. Why is another open question. We do know that he received some income for his work, but according to Brandon's story that we've heard from the FBI and others, he came to the police because he was concerned about some illegal activity in another case, and he was really worried about that. And at that point, the police brought him to the FBI, and he started working that case, and that preceded David and Brad. So we do know that he was an informant prior to working David and Brad's case.
And we do hear in the film from a former girlfriend who talks about how conflicted he may have been with all of this. She even says in some ways he had sort of fallen out of the limelight in some way, and he wanted to be kind of the hero again. And maybe this was his clumsy attempt to do that, I guess.
I think there's a handful, if not more, of activists in Austin and in New Orleans that have felt that sort of his style of work down there was, you know, a lot of them are anarchists and they believe in consensus building, and that is not the way he operated. And so there was a friction between them, and there was a falling out between many of the activists and Brandon. And so I think it's fair to say that he was feeling sort of pushed out by that community, and the girlfriend sort of guesses that perhaps that's what led him to the FBI.
Yeah. When you when you've screened this film, and when people have seen it, particularly in Austin, let's see how to put this question. People have to be kind of pissed off about Brandon Darby, right? I mean, there has to be kind of an intense sense of feeling about it.
I think there is, for sure. Right. He, as Kelly said, he did incredible work after Katrina. He was sort of a legend in Austin. And I don't know so much about New Orleans. We spent more time in Austin. But, you know, by the time he met David and Brad, his reputation preceded him. And so David didn't know about him, but Brad had heard about Brandon and his incredible work after Katrina. And so when it first came out, before Brandon wrote his open letter to the activist community saying, in fact, it is true, it came out accidentally, that it came out in a courtroom. And there were activists who had worked side by side with Brandon for years who immediately came out and said, this is absolutely not true. This is a COINTELPRO move. Brandon is the last person who would ever be an informant. And so, you know, I think it's safe to say that hearts were broken and anger was fierce and continues to be among some, because there's a deep sense of betrayal. And so that continues for sure.
Katie Galloway and Kelly Duane de la Vega are with us. They directed and produced Better This World. Next week, it's going to screen Friday and Saturday as part of the Salt Lake City Film Festival. The festival gets underway on Thursday. We should mention that the film is also going to be part of the PBS series POV next month. For more information about that, go to our website, kuer.org/Radio West. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the film Better This World. It is the story of two young men from Midland, Texas, who are arrested for making Molotov cocktails when they went to protest the Republican National Convention in 2008. The film is a part of the Salt Lake City Film Festival and will be screened next week. We'll give you some details about that. Joining us on the program today, Katie Galloway and Kelly Duane de la Vega, who directed and produced the film. I want to ask you both about one of the elements of the film that we see as you're telling the story are these phone calls that we hear from recorded actual phone calls themselves from David and I guess it's mostly – yes, it's David and his family. And I just wanted to play one of these elements, which is David talking to his girlfriend, Emily. I wanted to play it just to give people a sense of the kind of drama that you can hear in that. And also it seems so – you'll hear the – they only have so much time to do this, and then all of a sudden it just cuts off. I guess we should say, Katie and Kelly, that David and Emily are talking after they've been arrested, and these are the sort of earliest days. I guess you know the clip. Anything else to say about that before we play it?
Yeah, this is just soon after David's been arrested, and his girlfriend Emily did not come to the RNC, the Republican National Convention, right, with him. So she's watching the news unfold back in Austin.
Hello, this is a collect call from
David,
an inmate at the Sherburn County Jail in Minnesota.
Hello?
David?
Hey.
Really worried about you. I called the county jail as soon as I heard that you were arrested. And then that night you were on the local news, like on TV. It was like two Austin men have been arrested for conspiracy to throw explosives.
Yeah, what did it say?
Most of the news reports just said that group.
What they're thinking of as a group and like what they're trying to investigate is nothing more than, you know, me and Brad hanging out at my house.
Yeah, I know.
They're trying to make this like a landmark case. But I don't know if they're gonna give me like domestic terrorism charges or.
Oh, David.
Thank you for using Evercom.
Katie and Kelly, I had heard an interview where you were talking about the fact that when David showed this in the prison where he is now. People were really affected by that. The limited amount of time that you have to talk to your loved ones, I guess.
That's right. They were, after everybody in prison saw it, they thought, you know, you only get like an allotted 15 minutes and about it takes about 15 minutes to sort of get people talking about things that are difficult, whether it's your stressed relationship with your wife or you're apologizing to your parents. And they always get cut off and it's like this knife in the heart. So they said when they heard it, it had this whole other sort of impact to the prison population that he watched it with.
Seems right. Like, and there's this sort of sing-song voice, thank you for using Evercom or whatever. You know, so it's like right at this moment when some critical piece of information needs to be get conveyed, they get cut off. And certainly audiences respond to that in theaters where we've been. And it's David said it was just resonated very deeply with the group of prisoners he watched it with, for sure.
I want to ask you about the way activism, the sense of activism plays out in the film. Seems like there are two different versions of activism in some ways. One, you know, deeply principled and inspiring, people want to change the world. And then there's that other version where, you know, when it crosses a line, when it may seem a little naive and even a little bit reckless. I mean, how naive are these guys, do you think? And what does that say? How are you guys assessing their, you know, the way their activism is evolving in the film?
I think, you know, by their own admission, they were pretty naive when the story starts for us. But in the time that they went to this Austin bookstore to find out about the possibility of protesting the Republican National Convention, basically there was a group of anarchists from Minneapolis who were doing a roadshow and inviting people to come and protest the RNC. And they went to sort of check it out and certainly hadn't made any commitments. David was just giving Brad a ride to the bookstore, and then Brandon approached them there and suggested that they think about working together. They didn't have any sort of concept of how to be useful as activists. Brad had given a fair amount of thought to wanting to be useful. He had been politicized in high school around the Iraq War, and you know, they didn't have any structure to fit into. I know now they're not as naive, and Brad is just as committed to activism as he ever was, if not more. But he talks about it in a very different way. He's been on the film festival circuit with us some, and he talks a lot about the quote unquote unsexy work of daily organizing, of like picking up trash in your neighborhood, of going, you know, door to door to work for some kind of local change. He really lives the kind of think locally model.
Well, you know, I just, as Kelly chiming in, but one of the things that I really drew me to the story was the impulse of particularly young activists to sort of push themselves and cross a line. And one of the reasons why I thought the story was intriguing was because, you know, Dave and Brad did cross a line, and they're not, you know, perfect little innocent lambs. You know, they are complicated characters, and there is that impulse. And I think it makes for a richer story. I think it touches a lot of people that were political when they were younger, and they think back to those times. And as they've aged and gotten more experience, maybe the way in which they express their political beliefs has changed. But that passion can sometimes be incredibly empowering, but it can also at other times lead you to do things that aren't that smart.
And David and Brad both are, they have a ton of lament, obviously, yeah, at this point, about not just for having gotten caught with Molotov cocktails, but for how they thought about what was effective at that time. And they don't apologize for, you know, they both take responsibility for their own actions. And while they believe in various ways that the government is culpable in how things unfolded, and they both certainly question whether they would have done what they had done had they never been involved with the government informant, to say the least. They also are not shy at all about taking responsibility for their own misjudgments and their own bad choices. And it's something that they both, you know, they both live with quite a bit of guilt and sorrow about what they did in terms of what they put their families through, especially. I mean, that's a big, important part of the story we tell, is the sort of collateral damage around a domestic terrorism case in terms of what it puts loved ones through.
Well, as you said, Brad and David both are willing to take responsibility for what they've done, but they're going to have to try, as it plays out in the film, to explain how it really went down in the context of a federal trial. And in the context of this, you know, plea arrangement system, and that seems like another important theme, the way the sort of heights of their ecstatic activism and how that plays out in the face of the realities of that system of justice. Talk a little bit about that, because I guess the question is, what is the role of a plea deal in terms of what is it interested in? Is it interested in retribution? Are we really trying to get at the truth? Are we trying to get at one side of it? I mean, what did you learn about that part?
Well, we know that the vast majority of people in the federal system take pleas. Part of the reason is that the federal system delivers very punishing sentences, much more than the state system. So Brad has a moment where he's talking to his lawyer and he says it's game theory. Basically, they offer you 2 years or 3 years if you take a plea. And otherwise, you could be looking at 15 or 30. And so he argues that, and I think, you know, there's some truth in this, that even a person who's straight up innocent would have to look at those odds where the conviction rate is 90% plus and say, is that a gamble I want to take? And entrapment cases are notoriously difficult to prove because the definition is very slippery. Different definitions can be accepted in court. So talk about a gamble with your life to go to trial, which is what David decided to do. And at the time he decided to go to trial, he did not understand those odds. So Brad did what almost everyone does and took a plea. But David took this massive gamble, which is part of the, you know, the big drama of our story is watching how that plays out.
Mm. Let me play that clip you're referring to, Brad talking here to his defender, Andrew Mooring, about the plea deal, about how the what the system is really interested in. Again, from the film Better This World.
Under the federal sentencing guidelines, there's a built-in punishment for going to trial. There is a direct cost in prison time for exercising your right to trial. That's how it is. The system's built that way. The rules are written that way.
You go to trial, you're looking at 10 to 12 years. You take a plea deal, you're looking at two and a half. I mean, that's game theory. What are you going to do? You know, I mean, what is an innocent person supposed to look at it and look at the conviction rates for the federal courts and say, well, that 8-year swing is something I'm going to go after. You know, the prosecution has unbelievable amounts of power in the negotiation process to make sure people don't go to trial. They don't like it's playing games. They don't like to have games played with them. That's what people consider going to trial. Exercising your right is playing games in the federal system. It's like going to trial is you're a liar and you don't want to take responsibility. And I can't believe this. When what you want to do is like lay out all the evidence and say, look, this is the whole story. This is what actually happened. If I am guilty, then convict me. But don't bank me. Don't, you know, give me, you know, dozens of years more just because I wanted to have the full story laid out.
Katie Galloway and Kelly Duane de la Vega, let me ask you about David then. Talk about the decision that he has to make. You were referencing it there before. It's a difficult one. On one hand, he wants to tell his story, but then that means facing a lot of time. And he kind of goes back and forth. Talk a little bit about the decision he's having to make.
Well, so when David hears that Brad took a plea and he hears, you know, the amount of years that Brad is looking at, which was really initially somewhere between 2 and 4 years, he thought, you know what, I'm going to take a plea too. I'm just going to put this behind me and suck it up. But that's not the plea offer he got. And the prosecutor offered him possession and manufacturing, but also intent. And David felt very strongly that he never intended to actually use them. I mean, he built them and then he and Brad together made a decision of what to do with them. And so at that time he thought, well, 7 years is I'd rather gamble it and put everything out on the line and tell my full story. And he did feel manipulated by the government informant. And he did feel that was something that needed to be aired. His father, who's a key character in the film,
yeah.
Michelle, he's French-Canadian. His father also really felt like, you know, this relationship between him and the informant was not okay, and that it was important for that to play out in front of a jury. So his father was very supportive of him going to trial. And once he was looking at substantially more time than Brad, even if he took a plea, he decided, you know, and he was terrified, utterly terrified, but he decided to take it to trial and to roll the dice and lay out his case.
What do you make about David's relationship with his father? I mean, his father's very principled, of course, but it's his son who's in prison. It's his son who's facing this time. And there are times, I think, when I thought, gosh, isn't he being a little reckless with his son to say, yeah, we should test this, we should fight this. And David seems, there's one particular moment where we hear a phone conversation. David seems terrified and completely uneasy with it, but his dad seems like, let's do it. But this isn't his life,
yeah.
It's his son's.
Yeah. I mean, you're not the first person who said that. And it's interesting because this is this thing that I go back to and Katie and I talk about is that they are sort of in between boys and men at this moment. And Brad's family, basically, as I understand it, called him up and said, you know, did you make these? He said, yes. And then they said, be a man and you take responsibility and you plead guilty. And he did that, you know, not to say that he didn't have his own independent thought, but he did. He took his parents' advice. On the flip side, you know, David's parents are saying, this is outrageous. You know, the government manipulated you. You need to stand up, be a man and stand up to them. And so, and he took his family's advice. And ultimately, you know, I think you could argue that he was fighting for something that his son ultimately had to sort of serve the time. I think his outrage was so strong that he had a hard time sort of sitting back and saying, you know, considering what it meant. But he also, in other calls that aren't in the film, does discuss it with him. He also had a defense attorney that was in that, as I understand it, was, you know, suggesting he go to trial. I think David was alone in making the decision ultimately. And, you know, I hesitate to say Michelle was reckless, I think, but I do think that he, you know, he felt more confident if the story was all laid out that his son would be released from prison. And in fact, he still believes that if he could have gone back, you know, if he could gone back to trial, things might have gone a little bit differently.
It's interesting because for the first time I've thought of a quote from Michelle that's early in the film in these terms relating to his own family. He says when he's sort of grappling with finding out his son David has been arrested and how could this have happened, he says, all my life I've taught my kids to stand up for the weak, to stand up for people who are defenseless, but I never knew that this is where he was going. But in the context of what we're talking about now, I think Michelle very much saw David, his son, as the defenseless in the face of, you know, federal domestic terrorism charges. And he felt, you know, he calls it, this is David and Goliath, he says to his son on the eve of trial. But David won, remember? So it's not that they're big and strong and crooked, that they're invincible, you know, as he's sort of propping his son, who is absolutely terrified, facing 30 years in prison, up on the eve of trial.
Well, as we head into a break here, let's play that moment from the film. This is from the film, Better This World.
If I'm found guilty and I take my sentence, you know, I got to do what I have to do. You know, I can't just give up. And I can't just give into a situation that would take total, you know, take everything away from me. I'm not going to let it take away my, you know, who I am or what I believe.
Okay.
I don't believe that what they've done is right.
I know that you're worried. I know that you're nervous. So am I. Okay? Now it's coming down to the midnight hour.
Yeah.
Okay? The only way to beat these guys is to go to court and beat them.
Sir.
Okay?
Yes, sir.
You know, it's David against Goliath.
No.
Okay? But, you know, David won, remember?
Yes, sir.
So I want you to think that, you know, it's not because they're big and strong and crooked that they're invincible, you know? And, you know, you have a lot of courage.
Thank you.
Have a lot of courage, and I have a lot of respect for you for that, you know? I want you to know that if we lose, well, we're just going to lose a few years, but after that, you know, you'll have a wonderful life after that.
Okay.
And I'll make damn sure of that. I love you, and I will see you in the courtroom tomorrow.
All right, I love you.
From the film Better This World, which premiered at South by Southwest this year, we're talking with Katie Galloway and Kelly Duane de la Vega, who directed and produced the film. It's going to screen Friday and Saturday as part of the Salt Lake City Film Festival. The festival gets underway next week, begins on Thursday. We should also mention it's going to be part of the PBS series POV next month. For more information about that, you can visit our website, KUER.org/Radio West. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the documentary film Better This World. It's going to be screened as part of the Salt Lake City Film Festival, which gets underway next week. And we should also mention the film, which premiered at South by Southwest this year, is also going to be part of the PBS series POV, and we'll give you details about that a little bit later. Katie Galloway and Kelly Duane de la Vega, who directed and produced the film, are joining us today. So I wanted to ask you about... what did you learn about the way the system, I guess the justice system, the way people are thinking, how did that change, everything change since 9/11? That seemed a crucial turning point in terms of the way we think about informants, for example, and I guess other things as well.
Well, there was a sort of earlier analog, which a lot of people bring up regularly when they see or hear about this film, and that's COINTELPRO in the 60s, broad-based use of informants that was reined in to some degree after the Church Committee hearings, which many people have forgotten about unless you sort of deal in the world of informants. But there were some restrictions put on the use of informants in the early 70s that, according to many of the FBI agents and vets we've spoken to, say really held for some time. But after 9/11, with the passage of the Patriot Act and a whole bunch of different pieces of legislation. I think the most recent one, June 2011, the latest edition of the FBI Domestic Investigations and Operations Guide expands agents' powers yet again to examine individuals' records without any suspicious circumstances and without any requirement that agents record their search. So there's been, since 9/11, an expanding use of informants, certainly, and an expanded power of FBI agents to do what they need to do to surveil citizens and to, from the perspective of the FBI, to prevent the next terrorist act. So we learned, I'd say we learned a lot about how deep and broad the scope of the informant network is since 9/11. Most of those informants are operating within the Muslim subcultures of the U.S. I think we looked at a case that is not atypical because political dissidents and activists, animal rights activists, environmental activists, these are groups that have come under heightened suspicion. And the use of the term terrorism has been more broad-based post 9/11 when referring to these groups. But the predominant community that has been affected is by the use of informants is Muslims living in the U.S.
I wondered what you thought about how the media had covered this story. I mean, we see a few of these kind of brief news clips here and there, and they seem to be kind of reflecting that there's this there's one sense of it, which is how it sort of comes across on the 10 o'clock news, and which plays against the depth of what's really going on. I'm wondering what your impressions were of how you saw this being dealt with and covered.
Yeah, I mean, I think with a lot of the mainstream media and the local news stations, you know, it goes back to that thing where you're selling a story by reporting a very provocative headline. And, I think the New York Times did some longer pieces, but a lot of the local TV news did these big quick hits. Mm. And I think they feed into a lot of our sort of fear mongering. And I think they also feed into this idea that we don't really understand the bigger stories, the complexity behind these stories. I've heard, about a dozen domestic terrorism cases. But once I start to look behind the quick hit headline, I start to think, what's really going on here? Hmm. And that was, in fact, a motivation of telling a really complex story and allowing a lot of the gray to come out. So people would think beyond the headline and think, what's the bigger story? And so ultimately, I think it's sort of the tragedy of this constant 24-hour news cycle where you're trying to be as provocative as possible and not allowing for the the complexity of these stories to really come out in any meaningful way in the mainstream media.
Mm. Yeah, when David, actually, the first day we met him and interviewed him, pointed that out, not only about the media, but about the justice system. Yeah. And part of when people ask why were people so willing to open up to you so quickly, because we had some very intimate interviews early on, David said, I've just been dying to tell my story because the media and the justice system, the judicial system, both operate in black and white. And there's much more gray to the story than that.
Let me ask you this finally, about a minute left. You know, we see Brandon we see Brad, and he looks like he's going to be okay. He's still engaged and he's still active. But there's always that question about, David's still in prison, and that question you sort of raised there near the end is, what's going to happen to him? What do you think? Are you hopeful? I mean, he seems he's having these dreams in prison. So what do you think is going to happen to him? Do you guys feel hopeful for him?
You know, I think we do feel hopeful for him. You kind of can't not. We go and visit him. He knows about the film, and I think, not to pat our part, but people have come and written him letters afterwards that have sort of given him the sense that that he could have a life after prison. He has certainly dealt with some pretty scary stuff. I mean, he's dealt with, there's all these race gangs in prison, and he's navigated a lot of difficult things. A lot of his close friendships have sort of broken away, and it's changed the way he thinks about his relationships. But we are, we're hopeful that he'll come out the other side.
Katie Galloway, Kelly Duane de la Vega directed and produced Better This World. Next week it's screening as a part of the Salt Lake City Film Festival. Go to our website for the details. Katie and Kelly, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks.
Thank
so much
you
for
so much.
It was great.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.